fundamental. So the point was that we can use the favorite formalism to describe the Dirac equation nicely, because in a favorite formalism, the metric always is the simple matrix, therefore those gamma matrices can be chosen globally the same. And for the purpose of global conservation law, the tensor formalism is useful because tensor value differential forms can be integrated. If there are two forms, for example, of a two-dimensional manifold, three forms, if you have three forms or a three-dimensional manifold, and so on. So we start with the Dirac equations. In special relativity, this is a Dirac equation in units in which h bar is 1. As I said, here we have 4 by 4 matrices with complex entries. This is the ordinary partial derivative. This is the mass of the electron. And this describes the motion of a free electron. It's one free electron. A one free quark. Any spin 1/2 fermion. Such a four-component vector is also called a spinner. Those 4x4 matrices are required to obey this commutation relation, or anti-commutation relation. Meaning that the anti-commutator, it would be the commutator if there was a minus sign, but there's a plus sign, so the anti-commutator is twice the Minkowski metric. You will see in a moment why this is necessary, this equation. And it will be, and as I said, in the tetra formalism, the metric takes the simple form. By the way, I think I proposed as one of the topics for the essay that you might want to look into the relationship between the Dirac operator and the Laplace Laplace Bell. Maybe I make just a comment here. What if that was zero here? If that was zero here, then you would have simply an anti-commutation property. Remember where we had the anti-commutation property? The anti-commutation property came in the wedge product of one form. That's why the one form is anti-commuting. And now that gave us, together with the rest of the of all forms, give us the Laplacian algebra. Okay. It was an associative algebra, but it was not commutative, it was anti-commutative, at least as far as certain forms are concerned, the particular one. And you could ask, what would we have obtained if we had chosen the anti-commutator of one form not to be zero, but to be that? Okay. What would we have obtained then? You can do this, and you obtain what is called the Clifford algebra. It is very important if you want to understand how the Dirac operator is related to the Laplace operator and the Laplace operator, if you want to look into this. And you see, obviously, in this case as well, it's very useful to use the tetrad formalism, because you would work with just one matrix here, rather than having a complicated function giving you of x and t. So why did Dirac, who first came up with this, why did he want that equation to hold for the gamma matrices? Well, you see, Dirac came up with this equation here. His motivation was to generalize the Schrödinger equation. The Schrödinger equation is an equation which is having only a first derivative in time. And so he thought the relativistic generalization of the Schrödinger equation should also have only first time derivatives, not second time derivatives. So he was looking for an equation that is linear in time derivatives. Well, and then because of Lorentz symmetry, it better be linear in the space derivatives as well. So he said, well, that's essentially what we should have, that sort of equation. But what could the gammas be? And the motivation was that the gammas ought to be chosen in such a way that each component of this spinner obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. See, he wanted the Klein-Gordon equation to be obeyed because that was obviously a Lorentz covariant equation. Now, how can that be? How could you have that each component of psi obeys the Klein-Gordon equation? Well, let's see. Take the Dirac equation, and that would be this expression, psi is equal to zero, and multiply with that, then it's still equal to zero. If we multiply this out, allowing that the gammas are matrices and not numbers, then we obtain terms that involve gammas and gammas, we get gammas and deltas, and m squared. Since we have a relative sign between this term and that term, the mixed terms drop out, those two, and we're left with just this and that. So the Dirac equation implies that equation here, when we have just two gamma matrices and two derivatives. But the two derivatives compute with another. Doesn't matter whether I first partially differentiate in the new direction, then in the new direction, or the other way around. So if there is an anti-commuting part in this, it doesn't matter. It will be dropping out after being multiplied with this symmetric thing here. So we might as well just consider the symmetric part of this. The symmetric part of this is that. Okay? Remember that whenever you have A, B, whenever you have a matrix A with indices I, J, you can always decompose it uniquely into a symmetric part and the anti-symmetric part. So here we're keeping track of the symmetric part. The anti-symmetric part will drop out of the equation. So the symmetric part, see, this is the same with the exchange of mu of mu, multiplied with d mu du, is m squared psi is equal to zero. All of this is implied by the Dirac equation. Now, if this combination here comes out to be the eta mu nu of the Minkowski metric, well, then this is the Dalembert operator. And therefore, this is the Dalembert equation. So therefore, Dirac said, well, that's good. We know that the Klein-Gordon equation can be described, can be used to describe quantum mechanics relativistically. So we had some drawbacks. Because the second time derivatives, it allowed obviously also for negative energy solutions. And he thought, if I can do it with just first derivatives, maybe I can avoid that problem. So he required that each component of the Dirac equation, of the spinner field, obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. This is what comes out here. But actually, the motivation of Dirac was all wrong at the end. So maybe I shouldn't go too much into it, because he was trying to avoid the existence of the prediction of negative energy particles and so on that the Klein-Gordon equation has a problem with. But its formulation also has the same problem. And the solution is that there are antiparticles, and it has to do with the boundary conditions that are imposed on that differential equation that will let antiparticles propagate backwards in time, particles forward in time, and in this way, everything just looks like regular particles, except that the antiparticles propagate as opposite particles. That's the solution to the whole problem, but it's not so important historically how Dirac motivated his Dirac equation. The point is that he wanted this step. Each component of the spinner obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, and for that purpose, you need that this anti-commutator is eta mu times the identity matrix, so that for every component of psi, you get the Klein-Gordon equation. Yes. So keep in mind that the anti-combinator of that is, of course, a 4x4 matrix. So what we want is that this is a 4x4 identity matrix multiplied with eta mu. Maybe I should put that here. It's a 4x4 identity matrix times that. The 4x4 identity matrix acting on these four spinners here. Okay. Now, how do we do that in general relativity? We're choosing a tetra, also a number coordinate system. We achieve that the metric takes the single form at every point. Therefore, we can choose just one set of those Kalman matrices. And so we should be, in this case now, all we have to do is write down the Dirac equation again. We use those gamma matrices. We know that you can use the same gamma matrices at every point. And all we have to do is replace the ordinary partial derivative that would be at this point with the covariant derivative, right? So instead of covariantly differentiating in the direction of d by dx mu, instead of taking the ordinary partial derivative in the direction of e mu, we take the covariant derivative in that direction. The trouble is, well, this is a good idea, this is the right idea. We have no idea what that might be, because this is not the covariant derivative of a vector or a tensor, as we have seen before. This ought to be the covariant derivative of a spinner, which is a whole different kind of animal. So what we'll have to still find out is, what is the covariant derivative of a spinner? What is the affine connection type to a spinner? Now for that purpose, we have to remember what the affine connection does in any case. What is it really doing? What is the thing? Remember from the last hour, we said that the affine connection tells us by how much a vector is rotating as we are parallel transporting it. That's what it's doing. So in this case, we are asking, how much is a spinner rotating? By what sort of matrix is a spinner rotating as we parallel transport in a direction E? There has to be some close relationship between what the affine connection does to a vector and what the affine connection does to a spinner. I mean, what it does to a tangent vector and what it does to a spinner. It has to be a close connection. Why is that? Well, when you do parallel transport in the direction E mu, then a vector will be rotated by a certain infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. And we know what it is. It's the output of the connection one form. Output of the connection one form gives us an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. And we know how a Lorentz transformation acts on a tangent vector. We also know how a Lorentz transformation acts on tensors and so on, but in particular, we know how it acts on a tangent vector. And that's how we were able to parallel transport and covariantly differentiate vectors. Now, the trick, the key idea for finding out how the covariant derivative of a spinner works is this. Look at what a covariant derivative of a vector does. We parallel transport in the direction of E mu, and then we ask, what is the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation for that? Once we know what the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation is for a particular parallel transport, then we look at the spinner and we say, well, how is the spinner Lorentz transformed? We can learn that from special relativity, how the spinner Lorentz transforms. And then we apply that infinitesimal Lorentz transformation that comes from the parallel transport to that spinner. Okay? So the idea is, let us remember how spinners are Lorentz transformed from special relativity. And then let us figure out which is the Lorentz transformation that comes with a particular parallel transport in the direction of the mu, let's say. And then put one and one together and say, well, we apply this much of, this infinitesimal Lorentz transformation in the way that Lorentz transformations always act on spinners in this case as well. So that's going to be our strategy there. It has to work this way because of the equivalence principle. After all, we can always locally reduce everything to special relativity. So locally, it always has to work this way. So let's remember that the covariant derivative of a vector field gives us the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation by which the vector rotates under infinitesimal parallel transitions. And then the idea is, as I just said, the covariant derivative of the spinner should give us the rotation of the spinner by the same infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. It's going to be non-trivial though, because while a vector is simply Lorentz transformed by multiplying with the matrix of the Lorentz transformation, spinners have a much more complicated behavior under Lorentz transformation. But that's all. It's still the same Lorentz transformation. It's just that Lorentz transformations act highly non-trivial on spinners. So, remember how that works. The infinitesimal parallel transport of a vector, E rho, in the direction E mu, so this is the vector that we are parallel transporting, and this is the direction in which we are parallel transporting. Works like this. Our vector that we want to parallel transport is E rho. And if we parallel transport it infinitesimally in the direction E mu, then we obtain the original vector here plus the covariant derivative in the direction of E mu of E rho. Right? This is what the FN connection does. It tells us the infinitesimal change of our vector under parallel transport. And the covariant derivative, the FN connection of E rho in the direction E mu is just given by the connection one form. You feed it, it's a one form, and you feed it the direction in which you want the parallel transport, and out you get an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. So this infinitesimal Lorentz transformation now acts to rotate our vector E rho that we're parallel transporting, and the action is trivial. We simply have this matrix acting on that vector. That is how Lorentz transformations act on four vectors. So this is an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, where E rho goes into lambda. This is the Lorentz transformation matrix, E rho. Our vector comes a little bit rotated. We can write that as Lorentz transformation is the identity transformation plus a little bit. That's the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. And remember, this is an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation because it obeys this equation here. And we showed that whenever you have matrices obeying that, they generate infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. And by the way, here's the equation for why, when we do parallel transport, we get an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation that is really only rotating and boosting. And boost is really rotation between space and time. Why it is only doing that, and why it is not also changing the length of a vector? There is a physical, and there's an intuitive, and there's a mechanical reason for it.
The angle must be preserved.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Well, you could preserve the angle and change the length, right? But, I mean, intuitively, it's supposed to be a parallel transport. You're not supposed to stretch or, shrink your vector. Okay, it's just a parallel transport. So that should keep the length in there. But technically speaking, the metric is preserved. Remember, that was an equation that we imposed, that the metric is preserved. And that's more than just the angles, it's actually the metric. See, it's a vector in a product with another vector. That's preserved. If you choose the vectors to be the same vector, then it's just the length of the vector. That's preserved. Okay.
So the Lorentz transformation corresponding to the parallel transport of a timing vector and a spinner is the same,
Yes, the Lorentz transformation is the same. It's just the Lorentz transformation acts on vectors differently than they act on spin. You will have to figure out how they act on spin. Or I would just have to tell you how they act on spin. Okay, so now that we have the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation for an infinitesimal parallel transport, our strategy is that we apply, as you just said, the same infinitesimal Lorentz transformation on spinners for their parallel transport. To this end, we have to remember from special relativity, and I hope you do remember, how an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation acts on the spinner. Okay, here's how that goes. Assume that Si from I equal 1 to 4 are an orthonormal basis of the spinner space. I mean, the spinners are four-dimensional vectors with complex entries. So they live in C4, on R4 of C4. And we can choose a basis in that space of spinners. Four basis vectors, we just choose them. Then our spinner can be written in this way. It's going to be some coefficient functions times the basis. And of course, you can choose that basis any way you like, any way you like. Right? Just like the basis in the tangent space. You can choose whatever basis you want, anywhere, here too. But we want them to be orthonormal. Now, how do those basis vectors transform under Lorentz transformation? What we want to know is, we need to know that, because if we know that, if we know how the basis vectors change under Lorentz transformation, then we can tell what the affine connection does to the basis vectors. Because we know how much of a Lorentz transformation we need to do. And so in analogy to the affine connection parallel transporting E mu, a basis vector in the tangent space, here we want the affine connection parallel transporting a basis vector in the spinner space. We know that the affine connection applied to a vector E mu parallel transporting into the direction E alpha is given by the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation here acting on E mu, where it's the connection one form, the value agent on the vector that gives us the direction. Now, from special relativity, we know that under infinitesimal Lorentz transformations, vectors transform like that. Okay, you have that. Vectors transform by simply, if this is the Lorentz transformation, this is the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, then vectors transform under this Lorentz transformation into themselves plus a little bit, a small matrix times that. Very simple way of transforming basis vectors under Lorentz transformation. And here we go with the spinners, and it would take us too far to prove this. A spinner basis vector is mapped into itself, just like here, plus, and now here you have the Lorentz transformation matrix, infinitesimal Lorentz transformation matrix. That too occurs here, obviously. And then it's not just contracted with those basis vectors, but instead you have this matrix here. This is a 4x4 matrix, which is acting in the four-dimensional spinner space. Okay, so what you have here is the Lorentz transformation that comes, for example, from a parallel transport. But this equation is true even in special relativity. I think it was parallel transport, just a regular Lorentz transformation. And a regular Lorentz transformation, a spinner basis vector goes into the spinner basis vector. And then this matrix here, which is a 4x4 matrix, acting on that basis vector. I put here in the box And then a reminder for those of you who are familiar with the the Dirac equation, how that equation comes about.
Should all the indices of gases be the same, like the I? Or,
can you please?
Should all the indices on the S's be the same? Like
yes,
I?
They should, yes.
So it's saying that like the SI gets rescaled or something? Because you could factor out SI from both parts.
Yeah, but remember that this is a matrix here.
Right, but like you could take out the identity matrix in the first part.
Why would that be?
Like you could just write the first SI as like identity times SI, and then you could factor SI on the right side.
Yes.
Yeah, we're just saying that it's being parallel transported in S, but it goes to it. We're not saying it's equal to it.
You see, it's one, of course you could do that. You could say that this is 1 minus this applied to SI. So, so this 1 minus this is one big 4 by 4 matrix which describes the rotation in spinor space. And you apply it to S1, you apply it to S2, you apply it to S3, you apply it to S4. Same rotation actually that you apply to each of them.
Okay, I guess it's just not analogous to the other.
No, it looks very different, that's right.
Okay.
That's right, and that's because the Lorentz transformation acts in a simpler way here on those vectors. But Lorentz transformations don't act this way on spinors at all. Right. So what you have here is a 4x4 matrix, and you have it act on S1, have it act on S2, and it act on S3, and so on. Okay, so we can apply this now to general relativity. If a vector E mu is infinitesimally parallel transport in the direction of described by the vector EA, then E mu will obtain an infinitesimal rotation or boost, a Lorentz transformation. And we know what that Lorentz transformation is. It is given by the output of the connection one form when you feed it the direction vector which you parallel transport. This is the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation that every vector, every tensor, will undergo as we parallel transport in direction A. This is the Lorentz transformation. We know that it acts pretty simply on vectors, but we also know now how it acts on spinors. So vectors will go into under parallel transport, I mean, before it was just general, special relativity. Now, under parallel transport, we know that the tangent vector goes into tangent vector plus this, which is a Lorentz transformation, you want that. But, and from that, we can read off that since this piece is the covariant derivative of, by definition, of the tangent vector, we recover here the fact that the covariant derivative of the tangent vector in the direction of that tangent vector is simply this. So I mean, renewal of that. I'm just saying that if whatever occurs here is called the covariant derivative, then the covariant derivative is that piece. It looks tautological in this case, but it won't be in the case of the spinner. So when a spinner is I, and remember this is not one component of a vector, this is one vector, this is one spinner, this is one basis vector, this thing has four components, right? Maybe that was your confusion before. Right, so SI is one vector, it's one spinner. These are not the components of one vector, this is one vector here. So when a spinner SI is infinitesimally parallel transported in the direction of EA, then it too experiences the infinitesimal rotation, this is the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation given in this way. Everything experiences the same Lorentz transformation, infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, under the same parallel transport. It's the value of the connection one form. But now, if what we parallel transport is a spinner living at that point from which onwards we parallel transport, then what we have is that this spinner goes into the spinner that we had before, and then this action here that we had before, except that here the Lorentz transformation is now that Lorentz transformation that arises from the parallel transport. And it does the usual job. It is getting contracted with the commutator of the Galois matrices to give us a 4x4 matrix, which will then act on this spinner to give us the infinitesimal change of our spinner here. Now again, we know now what the parallel transport of S is, and everything that's in front of the spinner, of the thing that's being parallel transported, is what we call the covariant derivative. Now it's a complicated expression, and so we can now read off that this thing that is in front of the covariant derivative, this thing, the covariant derivative here, is itself. Right? So the covariant derivative of a basis vector SI in the spinner space in the direction of EA has to be that same. It seems a little bit more complicated than we perhaps anticipated. So now that we know how to calculate the covariant derivative of basis vectors in the spinner space, we should be able to calculate the covariant derivative of arbitrary spinners that are linear combinations of those basis vectors. You see, an arbitrary Dirac spinner is given by a linear combination of our basis vectors in the spinner space with some coefficients functions in front that describe the linear combination as a function of space and time. And we can use the Leibniz rule for covariant derivatives to obtain the following. The covariant derivative of a spinner thing is the covariant derivative of those coefficient functions times the basis vectors in the spinner space. Well, remember, the coefficient functions are just that, they're just coefficient functions, scalar functions. And this is the spinner. So what we have is the covariant derivative of the coefficient function, which is scalar, and therefore the covariant derivative is just the ordinary derivative, leaving the spinner the same, plus the coefficient functions, and then the covariant derivatives of the spinners. But these guys we can calculate. We just found the expression for them. So therefore, the covariant derivative of the spinner in the direction of dA is given by, well, you see, this is the covariant derivative of psi, a coefficient function. But that's just the regular derivative of it. But that's just the evaluation of the EA viewed as a partial derivative on the function. So we can write it in this way. And this we can write out simply as, using the fact that we know what the covariant derivative is of spinners. So we obtain that expression here. We finally arrive at the Dirac equation in general relativity. We have now the gamma matrices, they are just like in special relativity. And here the covariant derivative, where we have to use this covariant derivative. You know, this is the covariant derivative applied from 0 to 0, where the first term is just ordinary derivative, just the ordinary partial derivatives, and then we get those additional terms that involve the Dirac matrices, the Dirac gamma matrices. Which means that just like the Klein-Gordon field picks up additional terms in the Klein-Gordon equation. Klein-Gordon equation is no longer simply second time derivatives time derivative minus second space derivative minus n squared is equal to zero. It picks up a lot of extra terms because of the curvature. Here too, the general equation picks up extra terms because of the curvature. And explicitly, it looks like that. And so here's how the derivative equation looks like. Let me just ask this. If we work on Minkowski space, would it be guaranteed that this term is absent? Actually, it wouldn't be guaranteed. Because remember that what those guys are. Those are really just the Christoffel symbols, right? And in this case, you know, the connection one form is really just a Christoffel symbol where one index is the Cartesian form. And then we feed it the tangent vector and so on. And the Christoffel symbols are not tensorial. Which means that if a Christoffel symbol vanishes, it doesn't mean that curvature vanishes. And vice versa, if curvature vanishes, it doesn't mean that Christoffel symbol has. So for example, in Minkowski space, if you use polar coordinates, the Christoffel symbol doesn't vanish. So we have achieved two things here, actually. We have now managed to write a Dirac equation on generic curved space-time. That's valuable in itself, right? But also, we have now allowed ourselves to write down the Dirac equation in arbitrary coordinate systems. Totally arbitrary coordinate systems. Right? I mean, in generic curved space, there is no Cartesian coordinate system. There is no globally inertial coordinate system. Right? Any coordinate system is good. You can write on the Dirac equation every arbitrary coordinate system in this way. In particular, this means we can use this to write down the Dirac equation, for example, in polar coordinates, or spherical coordinates, or whatever wild coordinate system you want, even in Minkowski space. You will pick up terms like this. They will describe the central forces. But the point about flat spacetime is that you can find a coordinate system in which those terms are. And the point about curved spacetime is that you cannot find a coordinate system at which those terms vanish, except at one point. You can always choose the geodesic coordinate system in which you can stop these things vanish at one point. Then at this one point, this extra term will vanish. But can you imagine that it becomes more complicated to solve the Dirac equation in curved space. Also, the relationship between the Dirac operator and the Laplace operator actually is no longer as simple as it is in special relativity. It's a fascinating topic, and if you're interested in this, in these more mathematical aspects, to do with Grassmann algebra and Clifford algebra, and the relationship between the Dirac operator and the Laplace operator, and so-called Weizenberg equality that relates the two, you can look those things up and write it as well, if you're interested. Okay, so now let's move on to the third point that we said is improved when we use the tetrad formula. Global conservation. In special relativity, every energy and momentum conservation express some symmetry, right? They express translation invariance in time or space, or also rotation invariance. And in general relativity, you simply look at them. And we have always that this equation holds, but remember that this is not a divergence. And therefore, it doesn't lead to a true conservation law. It's just a Bianchi identity. It's just something that follows from the formalism and has nothing to do with the physics of it. And we found that only if there are Killing vector fields can we actually project this T menu to a one-index thing that has semicolon subtraction equals zero, so we get a divergence, and therefore we get conservation. Only if we have killing vector. But other than that, we don't. And in real space-time, we don't have killing vector fields. So the idea now is this. Still, there ought to be a way to do it. Because Newtonian gravity is not so bad. And we should be able to improve on Newtonian gravity without giving up general relativity completely, just improve on it. We should have some way of, at least in an approximation, being able to say that there's gravitational potential energy. Remember, the point was that in Newtonian gravity, gravitational forces arise from the derivative of gravitational potentials. But in general relativity, there's no gravitational potential or gravitational forces. The reason why things go on bent paths is that space-time is curved, and not that there is a potential whose derivative gives us a force. And in practice, we may be interested in the case of two galaxies that are gravitationally interacting with each other, for example. And there is no killing vector field for the whole story. But if we consider the system in a box, then large enough, so large that where the boundaries of the box are, the curvature is negligible, for example, then shouldn't we be able to say that there is so much energy in the box, there's so much momentum in the box, there's so much angular momentum in the box, for example, given that the box is big enough to be able to get curvature out there. Well, so we would expect that there is some notion of total box energy, total box momentum, total box angular momentum, and so on. Then we could have, you know, boxes collide with each other and so on. I mean, objects inside the box collide with each other. Each one, each item comes with its own energy, with its own momentum, and so on. Or we could say that whatever energy goes into the box comes out of the box again. There should be some conservation. What can we do? So the key problem is that there is no such thing as a gravitational potential generative. And it's not just that it's deeper than the fact that Newtonian energy is a scalar. And in general relativity, you have the energy momentum tensor, so that things go from being tensorial, from being scalar to going to tensorial. It's deeper than that. The point is that in general relativity, gravity can always locally be eliminated. You can always choose the coordinate system such that in a particular place that you might be interested in, there is no gravity. You can always choose a local coordinate system in which all geodesics through that point are straight lines. So this means that locally there is always a special relativity. And that means that it's hopeless to look, in principle, it's hopeless to look for a gravitational potential. See, the Christoffel symbols might be the closest to that, but the Christoffel symbols can vanish just by choosing the coordinate system. It's not tensorial. Second big difference to Newtonian gravity is that in general relativity, gravity includes gravitational waves, which means that when things gravitationally interact, they may actually lose energy if we can make some sense of gravitational energy. Then we have to allow that such gravitational energy actually escapes. You wouldn't have that because it doesn't have gravitational waves. So gravitational potential energy is elusive. Can't really do that in general relativity. There's no local tensor that would give us the gravitational potential energy. remember that in the action equation, we have the energy momentum tensor of matter on one side. And on the other side, we have things to do with curvature. And what we would have to do in order to make things look similar to Newton is to take those curvature terms and put it on the other side, where the energy momentum tensor is sitting, and then say that the sum of the energy momentum tensor of matter plus the energy momentum tensor of gravity, if such a thing existed, is conserved. That would be nice. But can you do that? Well, of course not. We can do something that's pretty similar. What we can do is the following. We can take the Einstein equation, and remember it takes this form if we use the tetrad formalism. Remember what the eta, alpha, beta, gamma is? It is the Hodge star of of basis vectors theta, alpha, theta, beta, theta, gamma. Therefore, this is a one form. It's a 0.3 tenths of a unit one. Okay, so the Einstein equation can be put into this form. And now, using the mathematical framework that we developed with tensor value differential forms, we can reformulate this Einstein equation in such a way that we put the curvature stuff here, over there, so that it looks as if we have an energy momentum tensor for matter plus an energy momentum tensor for gravity, and the left hand side is simply zero. Well, that would be the idea. We can't really exactly do that, but what we can do is the following. We can reformulate this in such a way that there's going to be an extra term. We put some gravity stuff, curvature stuff, over here so that it looks as if there were gravitational energy momentum. And on the left-hand side, what's left over is the exterior derivative of something, which is pretty good. It's close to being zero, because if we do an integration of the whole thing, then this co-boundary operator becomes a boundary operator, and we get something on the surface. And so we have a chance to get a conservation law. Okay, so our goal is to extract gravitational stuff that we can put into the form of some gravitational energy momentum tensor on the right hand side, such that what is left over on the left hand side is the d of something. As you can imagine, that is not going to be completely unique. At the very least, you could imagine you achieve this. You could always add something else that's a d of something and add it on the right hand side as well. Right? Then you would still have something of that form. You would have d of something plus d of something else, and then also on the right hand side you have plus d of something else, and you declare this to be part of the energy momentum tensor. So it's not quite unique. Now those things here, which would play the role of gravitational energy momentum, those things here would be called the Landau-Lifshitz energy momentum tensor, or the Landau-Lifshitz differential three forms. So we will later show that indeed we can pull off this trick, extract some gravity expressing terms here, throw them on the other side, so that we're left with only the d of something here. We'll show that in a moment. For now, let us see what we get if we achieve it. What if we can put the actual equation into this form? Well, then let us define the total energy momentum tensor, which is the energy momentum tensor of matter, the usual one, plus the energy momentum tensor for the energy momentum one form in this formalism here. Remember, it's symmetric tensor, covariant, two tensor, and one of the indices is declared to be a form. That's why we end up with the one form. So this is the thing that comes from gravity. We add it all together, we get now a total energy one form, energy moment of one form. And then let's see what kind of conservation law we might get for this total energy moment of one form. Okay, so what we have is that since the V of something is equal to that, then since the V squared is zero, we have that V of the right-hand side is equal to zero. So if in this equation we apply V to the left and to the right, we get a zero here, and we get V on that side as well. So we get a we get G of square root of G hot star, and this is the total energy moment of one form of matter and gravity is equal to zero. Now we use Stokes' theorem to integrate out this boundary operator, and we obtain that therefore. Well, we know that this therefore is zero. But that means that this integral over the boundary is equal to zero. This is the boundary of our box. So remember that this is a four-dimensional space-time gradient. This is a four-dimensional integral because this is going to be this is a four-form here. We started out with a three-form. Now that's a four-form. So this has to be integrated over space and time. So we take a chunk of space-time, a four-dimensional chunk of space-time, like our box, and we follow it over time. And then we obtain the boundary integral, where we're integrating over just the boundary of the box and the boundary of the time. So we choose the four-dimensional space-time region to be bounded by our large box B in space. So this line here corresponds to our box in space. You see, this is the space coordinate, this is the time coordinate, and we have only one direction in space plotted here. Therefore, our entire three-dimensional box just shows up as a line in space. And then in time, we go from time t1 to time t2. And we assume that the box is large enough that far out, and this is far out enough in space that curvature is negligible. Okay, so our integral star, this one, of which we know that it is equal to zero, takes now this form. It's the integral over the box boundary. The box boundary at the. It's the integral over the box at the early point in time, plus the integral over the box at the late point in time, and plus the integral over the time surface here, t, this surface t. And this is not an integral over the boundary of the box, but integral over the box, because at this point, this is the entire box in space, a point in time. And this would be a point in space, but a long time. And that is that surface t here, that's a time-like surface, and these are space-like kind of surfaces that are three-dimensional. Now, the sum of these things is zero, and we will assume that space is flat and empty far out in space, so we will assume that there is no contribution either from energy momentum for matter, space is empty, far out, and we will assume that also there is no curvature far out, and therefore, there's not going to be a contribution from gravity either. So that our tau, the sum of energy momentum for matter and energy momentum for those Lipschitz energy momentum for gravity, both don't contribute. So if we are far out enough, then the integration along low standard hypersurfaces will not contribute. Meaning that this third term goes away. So we end up with the statement that the integral over the box at the early time plus the integral over the box at the late time is equal to zero. Now, according to the integration rules, this integral is always pointing towards the inside of that volume. Remember that if you're integrating over a surface, you have to tell which direction you're pointing. And this is always to the inside. Now, we may want to choose here this direction to the outside, so that we're integrating always with the time direction pointing towards the future. If we do that, then this thing changes sign. Just because we flip that vector. And I indicate that with a little f here, saying that we integrate over the surface such that the normal vector to the surface is always future pointing. And then, since the sign has changed here, since the sign has changed, we obtain that this integral over the entire box is equal to that integral over the entire box, as long as we make sure that our normal to the surface is pointing to the future. Remember that when I say surface, I mean the entire three-dimensional space, because it is the three-dimensional hypersurface of the four-dimensional space-time. And into the fourth dimension, into time, it is pointing now always forward in time. So then we can define the so-called total ADM four momentum, where ADM stands for Arnovitz, Wieser, and Meisner, who first came up with this, in the following way. We define the P mu to be the integral over that expression here, where this is the total energy removal from energy matter and from gravity. And that thing then, therefore, is conserved in time. If we look at this equation, it means conservation in time. So if we call this thing here P mu or P alpha, then it is conserved in time. So it is indeed possible to have that. Right. And you can treat those as Minkowski tensor indices far out, because far out where there's no curvature and no matter, you can do ordinary Lorentz transformations. And then you behave as if it were ordinary special relativity for that. You could just say that this patch where things are going on can be simply subsumed, summarized, as saying that it is a patch in which curvature might go wild, but overall curvature plus energy momentum of matter give us a totally effective four momentum of that kind. But what I want to say is that this is possible. It is possible to assign a four energy momentum to a limited region of space, and if it is outside flat enough, if we can show what we assumed at the beginning, namely that the Einstein equation can be written as something where we have pulled some gravity part to the right-hand side, and the left-hand side just had an axial derivative or something. We still have to show that. Well, and we have to determine what the T alpha really is in practice. Okay, so our starting assumption was that the Einstein equation can be reformulated in the form B of something is equal to that. Wasn't unique, but there should be some way to do this. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's not unique in principle, it's divided by this, but it turns out that if you require that the key that you obtain, this thing comes from gravity. So the capital P was the energy momentum that came from matter, and the little p is the one that comes from gravity, by putting curvature stuff on the right hand side. If you want this to be symmetric as well, then it's okay, so here's the proposition that we need to show. And for the detail of the proof, I refer you to Straumann. That the Einstein equation can be reformulated in this way. And that's now spelling out exactly what we have the B of. It's that stuff. It's not really important what this part is, because that's going to go away. Remember how we proceed? We put an exterior derivative on both sides of the equation so that this thing is vanishing. Then we have the exterior derivative of that, and then we use Stokes theorem on them. Well, the main point of the proposition is that it tells us what those are the key are. It tells us what the gravitational analog is of energy momentum. Anyway, gravitational Lipschitz energy momentum one form takes this form where starts the Hodge dual of it. So we have the capital eta alpha eta gamma delta, which is by definition simply the Hodge star of the red product of all four basis vectors. Why would we want to use this notation? Well, if you write it out, you get epsilon tensors and stuff like that. So this is just a simple way of encoding what otherwise would be square roots of g and epsilon. And here we have connection one forms and our frame vectors. So in practice, that can all be evaluated, and we obtain our gravitational energy momentum. And this is the choice for which the gravitational Lipschitz energy momentum tensor is symmetric. So if that's what we want, that the overall energy momentum tensor is to be symmetric, then it's symmetric. So we now have all the ingredients to calculate the ADM energy momentum vector. Remember, that is a four vector. And it's not a four vector field, it's a four vector. It's just four numbers, really. And it is obtained by integrating over our box square root of t times the Hodge star of tau mu. The tau mu is the capital T, energy momentum, one form of matter, plus the little t here, which is that. So we have to integrate that over the box, and that whole thing is then our conserved ADM formula. Now, at this point, we see the first application of the dominant energy assumption, which is usually called the dominant energy condition. Namely, there's a theorem, the so-called positive energy theorem, which says that if the dominant energy condition holds, then the energy part of this four vector, the P naught, comes out positive. Which is a great result, because imagine there could be all sorts of things happening inside that box. Many nonlinear stuff can happen in general relativity. But what this theorem says is that no matter what happens in there, this always comes out positive. No. Remember that in general relativity, in principle, this is a highly non-trivial thing, because it too, just like Newton's theory of gravity, it is an attractive force, universally attractive force, which means that two objects could in principle get closer and closer and closer and thereby reduce their energy more and more and more, why should there be a limit to how negative the energy can get? See? And we know, I mean, we discussed that last time, that general relativity has a way of stabilizing itself energetically, that there is no bottomless pit of energy. And that is the fact that that holds you. So you can't concentrate matter more than a certain amount without forming a black hole, which has a certain finite amount of energy. And then it's not going to collapse any further and give us an even lower state of energy. So ultimately, this must include somehow knowledge, I mean, it's built into it, that general relativity has this self-regulating behavior. Just like in quantum theory, the uncertainty principle stabilizes the theory from, for example, electromagnetic gravity into that holes that stabilize from collapse. This theorem is not so easy to prove. We won't do that. But again, the proof, actually two proofs are mentioned in the post-Brecht part. It is also possible to define angular momentum for the stuff that is contained in such as rocks. And it's pretty intuitive. I'm just putting that out in here. And finally, there's one last thing I should say, which is that there's one non-trivial point that we have not really taken into account. I alerted you to the issue, but I didn't give you the solution. I'm not going to, but I'll give you at least the keywords so that you can look it up if you are interested in the details of it. The question is this: do we have to account for possible energy momentum loss due to radiation from the region of strong gravity? So we have our box. Inside the box, stuff is happening. Matter is interacting with another and so on. And then energy can be lost in two ways. It can be lost because there's light or other radiation escaping the region in which stuff is happening, getting out of our box. And also, gravitational waves can carry away energy in the sense of those Lifshitz four potentials. Now that is in principle okay. It doesn't seem like it's something deeper than what we would have done in ordinary classical theory. Radiation escapes a region, and that is just it, right? I mean, why would we care about that? It's obvious. You put in the radiation, you get out of the radiation, you get some radiation out of it, and that is simply part of the energy balance of the whole thing. And our calculations still hold true. We just have to be careful about our boundaries, what goes in, what goes out. But there is one extra complication in general relativity. And that is that the space-like hypersurface can be chosen to be what we may call bending up. See, space-time is four-dimensional. And at every point in time, we are looking at our box. It's a three-dimensional thing. It's a three-dimensional slice of this four-dimensional space-time. And there are many different ways that we can define a box. A box is a set of points in space which have the same time. Okay. See what I mean? If you take a snapshot of your box, then you are having a lot of points in space that events that all have the same time. That is what we mean by the box at a particular time. It's a lot of points in space at the same time. But remember that in general relativity, or generally in relativity, equal time is relative. Any three-dimensional submanifold that is space whose tangent vectors are all space, can be viewed as giving us such a box. There is no unique way of slicing space-time into slices of equal time, because you can always choose coordinates in which the time coordinate is different, in which the space coordinate is different. You don't have complete freedom, but there's a huge freedom in choosing space-like hypersurfaces. As long as it's space-like, you have hypersurfaces and you can look at a box. And the point is that you can choose your box in such a way that from one observer's perspective, from one coordinate system's perspective, the other coordinate system is such that equal time means that the further out you are, the faster you're traveling. Okay? You can think of a space-like hypersurface, it's space-like, but then you look at another space-like hypersurface, which is also space-like, but it's bending up. It's velocity, right? And the tangent vectors will always be space-like, but they can go arbitrarily close to being light-like. Okay? Far out, they can go arbitrarily close to being light-like. But if that is the case, then it affects the story with the escaping radiation. Because radiation is traveling with the speed of light, all right, but you could have a box which is bending, you know, which has, so to speak, traveling very fast from another observer's perspective, very outside, very far outside, so that the radiation may want to escape the box, but can't because the box is so, you know, traveling so fast. And therefore, there is an issue about how you choose your box. You can choose the box such that it's asymptotically bending up, so that you asymptotically either have or don't have a loss of radiation out of it. And that is something that you, of course, couldn't have in Newtonian gravity. So I just want to alert you to this fact that you can choose your space-like hypersurfaces that define your box in different ways. You can choose them to be bending up. And depending on your choice, you may choose what is called the Sachs-Bondi four momenta, which would be for particular choices of such bending hypersurfaces. So it would go too far to go into this, but I just wanted to alert you to the fact that this stuff exists. All right? And we're done for today. Any questions?
Can you draw that Sachs-Bondi box? No? Not on it.
Not really.
Oh.
I mean, let's think of it this way. Let's say you have Minkowski space, and you are dealing with a Cartesian coordinate system initially. Now you can imagine that you have, did you create a new coordinate system, which in your neighborhood is just a Cartesian coordinate system. And what do you have to do in order to set up a coordinate system? You have to distribute clocks everywhere. And then give each clock a space coordinate, three space coordinates, and the time body if the clock will give. Now, those clocks may be traveling really fast. And you can still get a good coordinate system out of this. And so the further away from you you're looking at clocks, the faster those clocks are moving. And so, asymptotically, as you look very, very far away, the clocks of this other, of this new coordinate system might be traveling fast, asymptotically with the speed of light. And that means that any radiation you might produce here is sort of, you know, it is numerically, as far as the time coordinate is concerned, it is slowing down. You could imagine that it's just, if you now define it with respect to the new coordinate system, of those, with those clocks that travel very fast, if they're far out, if you define with respect to this new coordinate system a surface of equal time, then you see that numerically those light rays would be numerically slowing down. Which is just to say that they are trying to catch up with those clocks. Of course, for any final distance, they will catch up. But if you infinitely far out, they will not. Any other questions? Do we still have any? Of those sweets left?
Yeah, we do.
Just try to get the quantity right for next time.
And there were fewer students today.
Yeah, Yeah, I hope that the others are not victims of this